From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We meet today less than 2 weeks after Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was tragically shot out of the sky in the separatist-controlled territory of Ukraine. And the victims of that crash and their families clearly deserve a thorough international investigation that is unimpeded in any respect, so that people have access to the site, so that the families can know that their loved ones are being treated with the decency that any family anywhere in the world would expect in these circumstances. The United States supports a thorough international investigation into this heinous act. And we support the efforts of the Malaysians, Dutch, and Australians to help the Ukrainians in order to secure the site so that those investigations can take place now. They're overdue, and it is absolutely important for the separatists to stand back and permit this access to take place. The work of the investigators is absolutely critical. It's been 10 days since this plane went down, and investigators have still not received full, unfettered access to the crash site. And without this access, they have no way to collect debris and no way to collect other evidence from the scene in order to be able to provide the kind of examination that is necessary. They still can't even ensure that all of the victims' remains have been removed. And that is an unsupportable burden for any family to have to bear. And it is an unacceptable standard for behavior, period. The site has to be cordoned off. The evidence has to be preserved. And Russia needs to use its considerable influence among the separatists in order to be able to help ensure this basic approach of common decency.
That was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Tuesday laying out U.S. demands that the investigation into the downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 be allowed to proceed and that access of investigators be unimpeded. His call came a day after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made a similar call.
I am very glad to see that the UN Security Council took up a more responsible position on this terrible tragedy with the Malaysian airplane flying over Ukraine and adopted a resolution which requires an immediate, independent and unbiased investigation. Our expectation, and this is exactly what President of Russia Vladimir Putin has been having phone conversations about with his colleagues from Austria, Netherlands, Malaysia and other countries, is that such investigation has to begin in the nearest future under the auspices of the United Nations. In order to make that happen, the Security Council needs to pass another resolution. We find it alarming that some of the partners are trying to steer the purely practical task of organizing such an investigation onto the tracks of separate bilateral talks with the Ukrainian authorities. By all means, as a sovereign state, Ukraine is entitled to sign any contracts it chooses and invite any kinds of experts. However, in view of the situation in the area of the Malaysian airplane crash, such as first and foremost the continuing shelling of the surrounding areas by the Ukrainian military, we are convinced that the parameters of the mission tasked with facilitating the investigation must be very clearly defined by the UN Security Council. They rely on its authority and provide security guarantees which this principal organ of the UN can and should issue. We hope that reason will prevail and that we will put at the task of finding truth and conducting an absolutely impartial investigation above all others, without any attempts to prejudge the results. As you know, the Russian side has done its best and is ready to keep taking more steps. We have handed over the results of independent monitoring from the crash site to international organizations, including the UN and OSCE. Russian Defense Ministry has held a special briefing on the issue. We hope that our partners, who have long been claiming to have some irrefutable evidence, will make this information public and transparent without pleading confidentiality, secrecy, or other reasons. The participation of all those who have any information about the crash should be fair and transparent. Everything else will be regarded as malicious attempts to influence the investigation and challenge the presumption of innocence. I don't want to throw accusations around, but I hope nobody will try to cover their tracks.
But that access has been blocked, and it's the U.S.-backed Ukrainian military assault that's to blame. On Tuesday, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte called on Kiev authorities to stop its military operation against independent supporters around the crash site in eastern Ukraine to allow the group of international investigators to reach the crash site. The group, consisting of Dutch and Australian aviation specialists and police officials, arrived Monday in the city of Torres, where the plane crashed on July 17th. But the investigators refused to work at the crash site for the third time due to security concerns. Following the ongoing clashes between Kiev and the independence forces, they decided to return to Donetsk, also for the third time. A statement by the Dutch Justice Ministry noted there was too much fighting on and around the road to the crash site for the investigators to do their work. A spokesperson from Ukraine's National Security Information Center, Andriy Lysenko, had earlier claimed that the Ukrainian National Guard controlled a number of cities, including Torez. Tuesday, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott expressed his concerns over the ongoing fighting around the crash site, adding that, quote, "It's not just the separatists, it's the Ukrainian government as well," closed quote. Meanwhile, President Barack Obama announced new sanctions against Russia on Tuesday.
"In recent days, I've continued to coordinate closely with our allies and our partners to ensure a unified response to the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 and Russia's continued arming of the separatists. And I've spoken several times with Prime Minister Rutte of the Netherlands and Prime Minister Abbott of Australia. Yesterday, I had a chance to speak with Prime Minister Cameron of the United Kingdom, President Hollande of France, Chancellor Merkel of Germany, and Prime Minister Renzi of Italy. We are united in our view that the situation in Ukraine ought to be resolved diplomatically and that a sovereign, independent Ukraine is no threat to Russian interests. But we've also made it clear, as I have many times, that if Russia continues on its current path, the cost on Russia will continue to grow. And today is a reminder that the United States means what it says. And we will rally the international community in standing up for the rights and freedom of people around the world."
Those new U.S. sanctions come on the heels of a set of EU sanctions announced earlier in the day. The Chinese Communist Party announced an investigation of Zhao Yongkang, the retired former head of domestic security, who, according to the New York Times, accumulated vast power while his family accumulated vast wealth. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
The Communist Party of China has begun an investigation into the former member of the party's top leadership, Zhou Yongkang. He is suspected of serious disciplinary violation. He's the most senior official to be put into investigation for discipline violation since the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. Zhou Yongkang, who is 71, was born in eastern China's Jiangsu province and graduated from Beijing Petroleum Institute. After nearly 30 years of working in the oil industry, in 1996, Zhou had been named head of the China National Petroleum Corporation. Between 1999 and 2007, Zhou served as Minister of Land and Resources, party boss of Sichuan Province, and Minister of Public Security. In 2007, he became a member of the party's top leadership and held the post of security, controlling the courts, police, and paramilitary until he retired in 2012.
At least 30 people were killed between Monday evening and Tuesday morning in the Libyan city of Benghazi in heavy clashes between militia members and government forces. According to media reports, the fighting in the eastern city involved warplanes and rockets. This follows battles between rival militias in the capital, Tripoli, in 2 weeks of the worst violence seen in this country since the 2011 U.S.-led NATO war ousted the government and killed Muammar Gaddafi. The Pentagon signaled Tuesday that it's mulling its largest ever shipment of Hellfire missiles to Iraq as the government in Baghdad digs itself in for a prolonged fight against ISIS. The State Department has approved the possible sale of 5,000 AGM-114K NR missiles and related parts and training, according to Pentagon officials. The estimated cost of the deal would be about $700 million, which dwarfs previous shipments of Hellfire missiles to Iraq. The UN Secretary General has raised an alarm about the forced evacuation by Israel of northern Gaza. Jocelyn Sambira reports from the UN.
The Secretary General has warned that if true, the forced expulsion of tens of thousands of residents from the northern Gaza Strip could have a further devastating humanitarian impact on civilians in those areas. The Israeli Defense Forces are reportedly dropping leaflets in the area, warning people to leave their homes and evacuate the city. The United Nations agencies in Gaza do not have the resources on the ground to cope with or provide assistance to an enormous extra influx of people, he noted. Mr. Ban Ki-moon strongly urged all sides to avoid any further escalation at this time. He also called on all sides to meet all obligations under international humanitarian law, both towards civilians ahead of impending attacks, as well as maintaining proportionality in any kind of military response.
As Israel continues to pummel what's left of Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has met with just about every national leader in the region, with the exception of the elected leadership of Gaza, Hamas. And by far, Secretary Kerry has been in the closest touch with Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, with whom he speaks, according to his press secretary, Jen Psaki, two or three times per day. Some have questioned whether Kerry is seriously seeking peace and a solution to the problem of Gaza, since he refuses to meet with Gaza's leadership. But in Tuesday's daily press conference at the Department of State with spokesperson Jen Psaki, information came out that suggests that, as Kerry won't meet with one side, the side he is meeting with doesn't want him involved.
Some of the criticism in Israel and among the pro-Israel community has been that the secretary is unwantedly inserting himself. I think one of the things was some commentator called him a nudnik, you know, some guy, someone who is constantly barging in and wasting your time and not actually doing anything. But he's saying here that he wouldn't be doing this if Netanyahu didn't want him to. And it doesn't sound, from what we're hearing from Israel, that Netanyahu really wants him to. So,
well, I think, and I'd refer you to them, right, Matt, but of course, as Said, or as others have raised, there have been reports, I know they've been retracted, but there have been a range of reports over the last several days about an openness or willingness to engage in short-term ceasefires. So I don't want to overcomplicate what the issue is we're talking about, which is whether we can get to a point where both sides agree.
Away from his comments.
Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar spoke with Natalie Herizi of the Party for Socialism and Liberation as she examined the role of the U.S. and the U.N. in the war on Gaza, as well as the global protest movement forming in support of Gaza.
Millions around the world are protesting in cities globally as the Israeli assault on Gaza continues. On July 27th, Israel's military denied responsibility for any deaths when a mortar hit the courtyard of a United Nations school that was shelter to many Gaza residents. It is the latest in an ongoing attack by Israel against the Palestinian people. Joining Liberation Radio now is Natalie Herizi. She investigates some of the breaking news.
Kerry arrived in Israel and he went to Egypt before that. I think we should view this in a particular context because this is the quote-unquote international community that's often bantered about. But, you know, the United States and John Kerry really represents the United States and its imperialist interests in the region. And I think we can see their presence there as a sign that imperialism is concerned about not necessarily the Palestinian people, because at this point, you know, over 600 Palestinian people have been killed. And an assault that's lasted 2 weeks, so just 2 weeks, hundreds of people, you know, almost all civilians have been killed by this assault. And it started 2 weeks ago. And there was no uproar from the U.S. government and even, you know, the U.N. There were sort of mild condemnations of Israel's violence, but, you know, the understanding of Israel's need to defend itself and against this rocket fire from Hamas that completely lied about the reality of the situation and what's happening in terms of the Palestinian people and Israel's assault on the Palestinian people. So they're not there because they're supremely concerned about the welfare of the Palestinian people. They're there because Israel is overstepping its boundaries in terms of its brutality and its violence. And I think there's a, you know, an intent to try and, quote-unquote, work out a ceasefire and to, you know, admonish Israel a little bit for its brutality. But we can see very clearly that no one is holding Israel accountable for the assault. And what is going on? I mean, you know, in the streets here, you know, on the streets here, there's been these major, major protests. And we're talking to different people and we're trying to build more protests. We could talk about that a little bit more. But in that, the course of that, one of the organizers here was speaking to someone who initially supported the State of Israel because of all the lies and the media and the propaganda that's come out about the danger that Israel faces. And, you know, she said to him, well, just imagine if this huge giant came and tried to knock you out, what would you do? You would defend yourself. And while that's a simplistic explanation, that's really what's going on is Israel receives billions of dollars from the United States. I think at this point it's at like $121 billion that has been spent on building up Israel's infrastructure, on building up its military in particular, but also, you know, its industry in the colonial state of Israel. And these billions of dollars are spent and given to what's one of the most powerful militaries in that region and is an apartheid state that is now attacking a people in Gaza, which is a 25-mile space that has been blockaded for, you know, over 7 years, that the people have been suffering under this particular blockade. But really this assault is, you know, part of a much longer war on the Palestinian people that's rooted in the theft of Palestinian lands and the driving out of Palestinians from their homes and the setting up of the State of Israel. And that's the context for this whole thing. It's never discussed. So Kerry and Ban Ki-moon being there is really, I think, them trying to be part of, you know, moving forward in the face of a brutal assault that could inflame the region, which is already inflamed because of U.S. imperialist intervention. But also, I think it's significant the resistance is going on worldwide. Really, the people of the world are standing with the Palestinian people. So we've seen protests across the world. And in the United States, the protests are very, very large. You know, 10,000 people in Chicago this last Sunday, 6,000 in L.A. and in San Francisco, you know, and hundreds in other cities that are much smaller and have smaller Arab and Muslim communities. So people really came out. And are out in the streets and are very upset about what's happening. Because what you see every day is these images of families, of children, of men and women who are just being brutally attacked.
Can we talk a bit about the ceasefire? John Kerry and others have talked about the need for a ceasefire and for Hamas to stop attacks against Israel. But in many respects, this ceasefire, as Richard Becker said on a previous program, has been blown out of context.
Right. So, you know, the ceasefire has different aspects to it. One is there have been previous ceasefires, and each time there is a ceasefire, Israel slips right across that ceasefire and kills someone and murders someone and bomb someone. So the ceasefire on the side of the Palestinians is viewed very, I think, as not really an answer to their situation and to the brutality they're facing every day. And, you know, the initial ceasefire that was offered was a complete joke. It was not something that Hamas or the Palestinian people could have accepted or trusted as a way to end the violence and the assault. You know, Hamas has asked for the conditions of the ceasefire to really be an opening of the blockade. And that's perfectly valid to say, look, you know, for our people to be able to access their jobs and to access water and medicine and food and all these things is a basic precondition for a ceasefire. And, you know, that's built up in the media and built up by the Israeli U.S. government is an unacceptable precondition. And, you know, rejected, where it's actually very reasonable and rational that to have this, you know, to have this ceasefire, you would need a condition that would ensure the safety of the people and some breathing room. The other thing is that I think, you know, if you read the news, I think today in particular, there's a number of articles that are trying to rewrite the history of the situation already, as if, you know, Israel was just sort of sitting there and Hamas sort of firing all these rockets at it. And so it was forced to fight back and to bomb Gaza. And then Hamas was using these tunnels, so it was forced to invade by ground. And that's like a ridiculous rewriting of the situation. Israel, in June, used the pretext of three Israeli settlers, and settlers are really colonial forces. They're racist forces that target the Palestinians constantly and are living on their land. And these three young settlers were kidnapped and killed, and the Israeli government used this as a pretext. They, put off investigating the murder of the three in order to be able to really go house by house through Gaza and round up hundreds of people and begin this bombing campaign. And so that's the pretext for the campaign that killed hundreds of people. And then, they initiated a ground invasion. When they couldn't break the resistance, they initiated a ground invasion, which, as we've seen in a short period of time, has killed hundreds of people. And all of it is now said to be because of rocket fire. Well, what is the rocket fire? I mean, if you look at the longest range rocket that the Palestinian resistance has, it goes tens of miles. And then you look at the longest range missile that Israel has, it goes thousands of miles. And they have nuclear armaments. And so these rockets are falling and not injuring anyone, although they continue as a sign of resistance against occupation. They're really, compared to what Israel is carrying out against the Palestinian people, having very little of an impact. Although the fighting on the ground has resulted in more Israeli deaths, I think we should really look at this. It's not like Hamas's rocket fire is the source of this conflict at all. And to call for a ceasefire, the onus of the ceasefire has to be on the Israeli military, which is carrying out this brutal assault and really, killing hundreds of people, as I've said. The Israeli military has to stop. They have to stop shelling beaches where children are playing. They have to stop, giving people a two-minute warning and then demolishing their entire houses. And that's where the onus of the ceasefire has to be, but that's not what's being put out by even Ban Ki-moon or the U.S. government or any of the forces that are speaking for the quote-unquote international community, but really in the interest of imperialism.
You alluded to this just a moment ago, and it taps to a question that I had is about the protests. How should people in the United States be responding to what we're seeing in Gaza right now?
There has been a call for a national march on Washington that is put out by the Answer Coalition and Al-Auda, the Palestinian Right of Return, and other Arab and Muslim organizations that have come together, and others as well, to call for a national march in Washington on August 2nd. And I think that's an important show of solidarity with the Palestinian people and resistance to U.S. support for the State of Israel. So I think, the first thing to do is try and figure out if transportation is going from your city, get on a bus or a train or a car to try and get to D.C. on August 2nd if you can. For those on the West Coast, there are coordinating demonstrations that are happening in Los Angeles and in other cities for those who may not be able to get to August 2nd. But August 2nd can be a real day, a show of resistance. But there are regular actions happening in the time between now and August 2nd in various cities as people really want to stay in the streets and be there in the streets resisting this. And I think, that is the most important thing we can do, is to go into the streets and to join these demonstrations because they serve a purpose outside just being in the streets, but, they're really viewed and people see them. They're educated by them. There's a lot of misinformation out there about Palestine and about Israel's assault on the Palestinian people. They go for more information, they find out more, and they join the next protest, and it becomes part of building a movement here. And it's key as part of our demands to be in solidarity with Palestine, to demand the end on the assault in Gaza right now, and to also demand that all U.S. aid end to the State of Israel. The billions of dollars that go there are spent on military and on the attacks on the Palestinian people and their homes and their families. And at the same time, in the United States, you know, Detroit's water is being cut off, and we're being told all the time that there's not money for schools or for jobs or for housing or even for health care, all of these things that could easily be funded in this country, in addition to supporting, you know, the rebuilding of hospitals and things like that in Palestine. Instead, it's all being spent on war and on violence.
Natalie Carrizzi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Liberation Radio. How would you like to close up this conversation?
Just by saying that I do think it's important to educate ourselves, to know what's the history of the conflict that's currently happening and the context to it, the different sides and what it means. I really would encourage people to read the book that the PSL has published on Palestine that Richard Becker wrote. I think it's a really great way to get educated on the history, which is an important history. It's a history of not just this one place, but the history of colonialism and imperialism in the region and its development, because Israel is really a representation of that. And then to also get involved and be really part of the organizing and try and meet other organizers and people who want to do something wherever you're at and become part of building a movement.
As Secretary of State Kerry fails to stop the killing in Gaza, cheers on the Ukrainian military in its assault on Ukrainian cities in the east, and continues to back heart-eating terrorists in Syria, his suggestions about what should be done with Iraq back in 2002 now appear to be reaching fruition. Imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal offered these observations from behind the walls.
Rogue states and broken nations. As the global news outlets flick from crisis to crisis, and as consumers' attention is drawn from crisis site to crisis site, the now unattended stories of yesterday continue to bubble and fester, uncovered and unseen. Since the beginning of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, that nation has been on the chopping block. Indeed, when Secretary of State John Kerry was a senator, he openly advocated the dismantling of Iraq into at least three separate sovereignties, Kurd, Sunni, and Shia. Today, as the cameras have stopped rolling, that shattering vision of Kerry's is becoming a grim, dystopic reality, but not the way American politicians and policymakers intended. Driven by the twin toxics of ego and ignorance, the U.S. neocons in power sought to serve the interests of Israel and the military-industrial complex, the destruction of Iraqi sovereignty, and the use of Iraq as a live-fire commercial advertising U.S. Marshal might. Remember shock and awe? Now, years later, with America aching economically and limping militarily, the dreams of neocons have morphed into nightmares. Iraq is but a memory. It was once a nation. It is not so now. It is a charnel house of warring ethnic and religious sects. It is a nation at war with itself. People once defined as Iraqis now call themselves Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, and they eye each other with suspicion and fear. That was the poisoned gift of the Americans. With rhetorics of democracy, free markets, and free elections, Americans marched into Baghdad with flag unfurled and trumpets blaring. In less than a decade, we see the real winners, Exxon, British Petroleum, and the like. Iraq won nothing but a continuing disaster. And what of the oafish politicians who brought it on? What of the authors of these war crimes? Nothing. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.